Hey, it's Matt. Before we get started, I want to let you know that today's show is an encore of a show we first aired back in December. So we can't take your questions or comments from social media or voicemail today. But be sure to follow us for topic updates and so you can chime in on future live shows. Your input is important and always welcome. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. And you can also catch up on past episodes wherever you get podcasts. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Police departments around the world, including in Elkhart, Indiana, have been using an unusual interrogation tool for decades. The method involves having suspects write down their account of a particular incident and then analyzing the language to find evidence of deception. Joining me now is Christian Scheckler, calling in from the South Bend Tribune. Thanks for joining us, Christian.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
And via Skype, Ken Armstrong. Ken is a reporter at ProPublica, a nonprofit newsroom that focuses on investigative reporting. Thanks for taking the time, Ken.
Sure. Good afternoon, Matt.
We'll start with you, Ken. It looks like this reporting stems from a prior report that you and Christian partnered on last July about what you called the questionable conviction of a man in what started as a missing person case in Elkhart in the early 90s. What got you interested in that case?
Well, Christian and I were working together in a partnership, looking at the criminal justice system in Elkhart generally. And this is one of the cases that cropped up early on where there were questions raised about the quality of the evidence used to convict. And when Christian and I started looking at the records in depth, we came across these documents about a tool that one of the detectives used called scientific content analysis. And with that tool, he evaluated the credibility of two leading suspects in the disappearance of a woman named Sandra Hernandez. And based upon his interpretation of their written statements, he concluded one suspect was being truthful and the other deceptive. And the one who was determined to be deceptive was ultimately charged and convicted. Since Christian and I had never seen this tool before, we really wanted to learn more. So that was really the impetus for us to start going deeper with our reporting on it.
Christian, how did the partnership with ProPublica and the South Bend Tribune happen?
So in 2018, ProPublica started an initiative called the Local Reporting Network, where they are supporting investigative projects at local news outlets around the country. And we were looking at some of these criminal justice issues in Elkhart County, and we decided to pitch to ProPublica the idea of doing an investigative project on those criminal justice issues. And they liked the idea, and we ended up being part of the inaugural class of the Local Reporting Network. And we got a bonus because we actually got to work with Ken and have his expertise helping with the reporting as well.
And Ken, you kind of gave us a quick overview a second ago, but can you maybe give us a synopsis of that Elkhart case, at least the parts of it that you focused on in your recent reporting for the piece?
Sure. It involved the disappearance in 1992 of a woman named Sandra Hernandez, and her body was subsequently found in a field in close to Elkhart County. And in the course of the investigation, the police focused in on a couple of her coworkers, and one of them was named Ricky Joyner. They ultimately convicted him, you know, based upon a number of factors. One was the testimony of a jailhouse informant. Another was evidence pertaining to plastic garbage bags. There was a plastic garbage bag found around the head of Sandra Hernandez, and forensic evidence offered by the prosecution linked that bag to another plastic garbage bag that had been found in the apartment of Ricky Joyner. And so the jury in that case was told that there was no doubt that it was definitive that those two bags had once been connected. And in the story that Christian and I wrote, we talked to other experts. You know, Christian talked to other experts, including statisticians, who said that there was a fair amount of overreaching in that testimony. So we looked at that forensic evidence, we looked at the credibility of the jailhouse informant, and then later, in a subsequent follow-up, we really went deeper on the use of this particular tool on scientific content analysis.
Yeah, and you wrote that police believe that Ricky Joyner was lying in part because of these two tests, the polygraph test and the test you just mentioned, which we call SCAN, and we'll get into the specifics of how this tool works later on, but what is that? What is SCAN? What's it meant to do?
It's meant to... What happens is this company called the Laboratory for Scientific Interrogation, it trains criminal investigators in the use of SCAN, and it teaches them to evaluate written statements to look for signs of deception. And it has a list of criteria which it trains people to believe are indications of truthfulness and to also look for signs of deception. And indications of truthfulness include such things as the use of first-person past tense. For example, I went to the store. An indication of deception is not using pronouns or avoiding possessive pronouns. So you're not going to say I or my. And the belief is that what you're doing is creating distance between yourself and the act that you're describing. And this makes you less credible. It's a pretty convoluted analysis that's used. And what Christian and I did when we were reporting on this is we purchased a number of sample analyses that have been done by the creator of SCAN so that we were able to share with readers examples of how it works when he's used SCAN to analyze written statements from leading public figures, you know, including former directors of the FBI, Anita Hill, Magic Johnson, people like that.
How long has this tool, this method, been around?
Since at least the 1980s. Avinom Sapir, who was SCAN's creator, moved to the United States in the mid-1980s and began training police departments around the country at that time.
Do we know how many police departments are using it around the country and apparently the world?
That's a good question, and it's a difficult one to answer. On the website for the company, they list 417 agencies in the United States alone that have received training in SCAN. And we know that's an undercount because there are other agencies that have popped up in public records requests or that pop up in procurement databases that we know have received training. If you go beyond the United States, there are all kinds of other countries that have received training, from Australia, Mexico, the Netherlands, Singapore, Canada. It's quite a long list.
We're talking with Ken Armstrong, an investigative reporter from ProPublica, and Christian Scheckler from the South Bend Tribune about an investigative tool called SCAN. Christian, was it easy to find detailed information about the tool being used by police in Elkhart?
It wasn't easy to turn up a whole lot of information. Some of these police departments that we've asked about their use of SCAN don't seem to have kept really rigorous records of who's used it and when in the department. We did hear from a spokesman for the Elkhart Police Department, for example, that the last investigators that had been trained in SCAN at the Elkhart Police Department have since retired, and so there's nobody there now who's using this anymore. But we don't know who all was using it and what types of cases it was used in, partially because this doesn't make it into the courtroom generally. It's not something that is actually presented as evidence to a jury. It's used by police officers early on in the investigation, as we reported, to sift true statements from false statements in identifying suspects or taking witness statements. But it doesn't make it to the courtroom, so we don't really see it come up in appellate cases and things like that that would allow us to really identify the whole universe of cases in which it's been used.
And so what effect did SCAN have on the 1992 Joyner case?
Well, Ricky Joyner was one of two prime suspects in the very early days of the investigation into Sandra Hernandez's disappearance. He was friends with Sandra Hernandez. He had apparently gone to dinner with her the night before she was reported missing. And there was another suspect early on who was also a coworker of Sandra Hernandez, like Ricky Joyner was, who had had apparently a romantic relationship with her in the days before her disappearance as well. And police gave each of these two suspects a written questionnaire where they were asked questions about Sandra's disappearance, and using their answers, a detective with the Elkhart Police Department determined the other suspect to be truthful and Ricky Joyner to be deceptive. And Ken was mentioning earlier some of the criteria that they use in determining apparent or perceived deception. For example, Ricky Joyner wrote in his statement that instead of using the phrase, "I went home," he said just simply "went home." So he left out a pronoun, and that was one of the signals of deception.
Ken, has any research been done to measure the effectiveness of this method called SCAN?
There has. There have been, at this point, several studies published in peer-reviewed journals, and in that universe, each study that has been published has concluded that it's no better than chance, no better than the flip of a coin in discriminating or in separating truthful statements from false ones. One of the most recent studies was published in 2016, and the authors of that study, three were from the Netherlands, one from England, and their conclusion was that it shouldn't be used because there's simply no empirical support for it. Their conclusion was that there's no science behind it, and therefore it shouldn't be used.
We will have more after the break with the reporters behind a new report about a tool used by police departments called SCAN. And a reminder to check out our podcast, subscribe wherever you get podcasts so you always know what we're up to. Just search for All In and look for our blue and black logo. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our encore show about an investigative report on a controversial interrogation tool that's been used by police for decades, including some departments in Indiana, I want to mention our last show. We heard from the Indiana State Librarian about changes we've seen at libraries in recent years, especially when it comes to technology. We also talked with two Hoosier librarians about how the physical space has been updated, and with IU's Ruth Lilly, Dean of University Libraries, on how modernization has brought back a focus on primary sources, things like first editions and historic artifacts. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In and be sure to subscribe. Today we're talking about SCAN, a tool used by some police departments in Indiana and around the world, covered in a new investigative report by ProPublica and the South Bend Tribune. We're joined again by the two reporters behind this story, Ken Armstrong from ProPublica and Christian Scheckler from the South Bend Tribune. Ken, are there any laws concerning the tools police departments are allowed to use while they try to solve a case?
Not really any laws that govern what tools they can use for investigative purposes. You know, in the courtroom, you have all kinds of case law that governs what is the threshold that must be cleared in order for evidence to be considered admissible. So you do have that. But even that has proven to be a pretty low threshold, because we found that evidence like bite mark analysis, bloodstain pattern analysis, a number of different kinds of forensic tools that have not really held up well under scrutiny have been allowed into evidence. with scientific content analysis, it has almost never actually been offered into evidence in court. Instead, it's used as a tool to help police determine what direction to go in, typically early on when they're deciding how to conduct an investigation.
And you wrote a bit about the detective who used SCAN in the Joyner case, who has since died. What did you find out about the training he received to use it?
Yeah, that was one of the interesting things about that case. You know, when Christian and I were looking through the files, we were not only able to find the questionnaires that the two suspects had completed, we were able to get the analysis that the detective had used. And 2 years later, he was deposed. So he was questioned under oath about his use of the tool. And he was rather befuddled by it. And he was candid about that. He said that his training in it was not great. And when they asked him how it worked, he kind of did the equivalent of a shoulder shrug and said, I don't really know. It's kind of like 2 and 2 equals 4. Why do 2 and 2 equal 4? I don't know, but it's just that way. So he basically said that he accepts on faith that it works without really understanding how or why.
Is there some kind of standard training you're supposed to give someone to use SCAN properly?
What the company does is they offer a 3-day workshop for basic SCAN training, and then they also have an advanced workshop, which is 1 day. So most of the people that we've run across in Indiana and elsewhere, they've either received 3 days of training or 4 days of training. And then they can also go deeper afterwards if they want. But that's really what it looks like on the front end. You get 3 or 4 days of training.
And I assume that the SCAN training offered by LSI, the company behind it, costs money for police departments. Do you know how much it is?
It's typically in the neighborhood of $600 to $800 per officer. You know, the pricing varies, and there are a lot of specials offered in it. We got records from at least 40 departments around the country that had received the training, and the amount they paid varied. And then in addition to that, that's just the registration costs. There are also travel costs, housing costs, things like that. Like we found, like the Texas Rangers. You know, if you think of Walker, Texas Ranger, the Chuck Norris show, it's that law enforcement agency. They've spent heavily on SCAN training in recent years. They had 26 Rangers get the training in 2017. They had 17 more get the training this year. One of the largest spenders has been the Defense Department. The Army has spent in total probably at least $250,000 in training for SCAN in the last 6 or 7 years.
There are a lot of testimonials on LSI's website about SCAN. All of them are anonymous quotes, but some say they're by students who just completed the training, some by participants who've used them at work. What did you make of these when you read them?
Well, as you said, yeah, there are no names attached, and they have a certain breathless quality to them. You know, if you look at them, they often have, you know, exclamation points. And one that we quoted in the story was from someone who took the training and said that now people just come up to him and start confessing. And what we found from talking to a number of different officers is that they really buy in to the teachings of SCAN. They really believe that it works. And there was one officer who Christian interviewed who said that he's even found that it's effective outside of work, you know, that he's used it at home with his family and has found it to be effective. So there's a real gap between what scholars who have looked at SCAN have found and what people, police officers who've used it, have said to us. A number of them really believe that it works.
Yeah, Christian, did you talk to anyone at the Elkhart Police Department or any other local police about some of the concerns around this tool? Who'd you talk to?
I talked to a investigator, actually a captain at the Kosciuszko County Police Department, which is just south of Elkhart County, who was one of the few officers that I could find who really, you know, remembered began and was willing to talk about how much he used it and how much he liked it. He's a captain who's in charge of the investigative and patrol divisions there. And he said he's used it on dozens of cases over a course of 20 years, from, you know, arsons to robberies and sexual assaults. And that he says more often than not, it seemed to point him in the right direction, and he was able to solve the case and find evidence that corroborated the direction that Scan led him in. But several police departments that I reached out to, you know, even though they were listed at one time or another as having been trained in Scan, really just didn't remember it or it didn't seem to have made much an impression on them.
Ken, what do we know about the creator of Scan?
His name is Abhinoam Sapir, and he has written a couple of books, and he also describes his background on the website for LSI. He's from Israel. He studied psychology in college in Israel and received both a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. Said that he worked for a while in a military intelligence unit in Israel. It's the equivalent of the NSA, the National Security Agency in the United States, and then worked as a polygraph examiner for the Israel police. Then he came to the United States in the mid-1980s, formed this company, and began conducting this training, which he's been doing now for more than 30 years. The company wrote a statement that we published in the story, which had said that they've trained tens of thousands of investigators over the years, and that Scan has been used, according to the email they sent us, to help solve hundreds of thousands of cases.
We're speaking with Ken Armstrong from ProPublica and Christian Scheckler from the South Bend Tribune about Scan, a tool used by some police departments in Indiana, including Elkhart, Indiana. Ken, were you able to communicate with Abhinoam Sapir at all as you reported on this?
No, he declined to be interviewed. So we published an email response that the company provided. And we were also able to account for the way Scan works and the teachings by buying a number of products that LSI sells. You know, we bought books that Mr. Sapir has written. We bought sample analyses that he's conducted. They also sell a DVD of a television appearance he did on a local access television station in the early 90s, in which he discusses at length how Scan works. So we were able, you know, even though he declined to be interviewed, we were able to use the company's products to really provide a good look at how Scan works.
Have you ever seen him respond to any of the criticisms that are levied at this method called Scan?
No, but we did interview people who have asked him personally about it. Christian interviewed a professor in the Netherlands who attended Scan training in Belgium in 2010. And she said that she asked him specifically, do you have any data to support this? And he said yes, but he said that he wasn't going to publish it, wasn't going to share it. And on the website, you get a similar sense. You know, on the LSI website, there's a statement about some government survey in which Scan had 95% validity, is the wording that's used, but it doesn't say what government agency. There's no link to any survey. So it's a number and a vague allusion to an agency is offered up, but there are really no hard numbers or descriptors behind it.
Ken, among the things you purchased was an analysis by Sapir, Scan's creator, on former FBI Director James Comey's memoir. What did Sapir say about it?
It was a bit surprising. So James Comey published a memoir in 2018, and Mr. Sapir did a lengthy analysis of it. And one example of what he offered up in his analysis was he counted the number of times in Comey's book. The book's about 290 pages long. He counted up 14 instances in which Comey described a door opening or closing. And I'm not describing this figuratively. I mean literally, like a door to an office, a door to the minivan, opening or closing. And in Sapir's analysis, this was indicative of childhood sexual abuse. And he wrote that that is because that's how sexual abuse as a child happens. It begins with the door opening. It ends with the door closing. He offered that same analysis at the training in 2010 that the professor from the Netherlands attended. And she said that when she heard that, she couldn't believe her ears. But that was one example of how he has used his analysis with James Comey. Another example is he believes that when people use different words to describe the same thing, that's an indication of deception. He refers to it as unjustified change of language. And in Comey's memoir, he sometimes refers to former Congressman Anthony Weiner's computer as a laptop. Other times, he refers to the computer as a computer. So based upon the fact that he sometimes calls it a laptop and sometimes calls it a computer, he said that that was an indication of deception. And, you know, he had similar analyses with other words where sometimes he used the verb left, sometimes he used the verb departed. He found that to also be indicative of deception.
How do tools like this catch on?
Well, I think law enforcement, they have always had an outsized interest in different lie detection tools, you know, from voice stress analyzers, polygraphs, statement analysis, and scan is a subset of that. And I think that if you are an investigator and you believe you can tell when someone's lying, that gives you an extraordinary advantage. But these tools have, by and large, been debunked whenever they've been tested in any kind of meaningful setting. So I think they catch on because they're just so attractive to law enforcement. And there's really been a lack of critical analysis of whether they actually work.
Is there any kind of structure to the way police departments around the country accept different tools and techniques as legitimate? Something like a best practices guide given at the national level?
Not that I know of. I really think it varies from agency to agency, and each agency gets to decide how it wants to spend its training dollars. And they are also often courted by various creators of tools. You know, like when we got records from the different agencies, we saw the flyers that were being sent by the Laboratory for Scientific Interrogation, in which it talked about how you can turn every one of your investigators into a walking polygraph. And it talked about how you can solve every case just by taking a written statement. It'll save you time. You don't have to do other investigation. And on the website, it talks about how, you know, you can send questionnaires. You can fax questionnaires to 100 people, get the answers back, analyze them, solve the case. Think of all of the time and money you're saving by doing that. It sounds very attractive, right? It sounds like a magic bullet in many ways. And I guess what's surprising is that a lot of police departments don't really think long and hard about, is that too good to be true? And instead, they invest and they send people and they get the training.
I mean, of course, there's a lot of meaning in the language people use and the specific ways people say things and write things. How would you respond if someone read your article and said, look, scan is just formalizing and expanding on something that all detectives do, which is interpreting testimony and looking for clues in what they hear?
I think I would ask people to imagine themselves being analyzed using scan. I mean, like one of the things that they write about is if sometimes in your writing, you might use the word kids. Other times you might use the word children. Or in Mr. Comey's case, you might sometimes refer to a computer as a computer. Sometimes you might refer to it as a laptop. I think that's pretty common. The idea that, you know, using synonyms is an indication of deception, is, I think, sort of unsettling. And the idea that that kind of tool could be used to help determine an investigation's direction is something that I think we should really think long and hard about, it, if that's an appropriate approach.
Got about a minute left. Research was started in 2010 by a task force called the High Value Detainee Interrogation Group, or HIG. What did their report say about SCAN?
It said that SCAN is widely employed, but there is a lack of supporting research. And the three groups that combined to produce this report were the FBI, the CIA, and the Defense Department. And what's interesting is that in a footnote, the same report mentioned specific agencies that use SCAN, and that footnote specifically identified the FBI, the CIA, and the Defense Department. So the very agencies that say there's no supporting research or there's a lack of supporting research for it, at the same time, they use the tool.
Mm. I want to thank you both for taking the time to talk with us today. Ken Armstrong, reporter from ProPublica. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Matt.
And Christian Scheckler, reporter for the South Bend Tribune. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
Up next, we'll talk to an education reporter from Northwest Indiana about big changes that could be coming to Indiana University and the way they evaluate student applications. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Some colleges and universities around the country are considering going test optional with admissions tests like the ACT and SAT, and some have already done it. Indiana University took the first step towards making the change earlier this month. Calling in from the Times of Northwest Indiana is education reporter Carly Lanich, who's been reporting on this. Thanks for joining us, Carly.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us what happened at IU with the Board of Trustees?
Sure. So this meeting earlier this month kind of allowed IU's individual campuses to take the next step in considering this test optional change to their admissions process. Now, the Board of Trustees at IU oversees individual campuses as far as setting policy goes. So when the Board of Trustees changes its policy, then each campus, for example, IUPUI, Bloomington, for us Northwest, can then make the decision themselves if they would like to be flexible in their admissions policy. So what we're seeing now is the Board of Trustees essentially giving the okay to IU campuses to adopt this new change.
Yeah, what effect could that vote have? Is it a guarantee that things will change and they'll adopt this policy?
Sure. So now what happens after the higher institutional Board of Trustees approved their policy kind of takes things back to a local level. So now what we're seeing is individual campuses deciding whether or not they would like to adopt test optional. For our story in the Times earlier this month, I spoke to representatives of Bloomington's campus and our campus here in IU Northwest. And both said that they have local level decision makers seriously considering making this change, which could come for students applying as early as next fall to enter the fall class of 2021, if those policies at the local level move forward.
Have any other colleges in Indiana fully gone test optional already?
Sure. So there's a number of smaller schools that have. Of note for us in Indiana, where we see a large grouping of students, is the University of Evansville and Ball State University. Ball State notably made the change August 2018. University of Evansville was around the same time looking into that fall 2018 class. So those are two of our larger schools that have done so. We've seen a number of smaller liberal arts schools as well. Hanover College is test optional for us in the Northwest region. We've seen Calumet College of St. Joseph take similar steps. So it is something that a number of schools here in Indiana are moving toward. We haven't seen, for example, Purdue University make this step yet. So that's maybe one of our larger schools we know students are looking at.
What is the argument to make this change that you've heard from people at IU?
Sure. So kind of the pros of this come twofold, right? The university is looking for really to give students the opportunity to present the best picture of themselves through their admissions process. And in speaking with IU spokesperson Chuck Carney, he explained it to us as even a data-driven decision, looking at the best indicators for student success once they enter and continue into college. There's been studies out that suggest that kind of snapshot of a test you see with the SAT or the ACT isn't as reliable of an indicator of student success in higher education as compared to maybe a student's GPA or their report card at the high school level. So that's kind of one reason that schools are looking to this. The other comes from a sense of really looking to diversify student body. So when this was discussed at the Board of Trustees level at IU earlier this month, it's also coming amid a conversation of trying to improve access for a diverse array of students and really opening up that higher education level to students where that one test score, maybe not testing as well as performing in other areas of your academic achievements or extracurriculars, may not be reflected. So this is also the university looking to broaden the array of students it considers through its admissions process.
Is this a trend that's been happening outside of Indiana?
Sure. So we've seen some colleges. It appears to be a lot of smaller colleges, some local universities at a higher level that have made similar changes. For us in Northwest Indiana, we're always looking to our neighbors in Illinois. So the University of Chicago is one that's implemented this. We've also seen similar steps taken at VCU, for example, or the University of Arizona, if you want to look further out. So it is something that higher education institutions, from a national scale, are starting to consider, I would say, more now than maybe we've seen just here in the last couple of years.
Have you noticed a push from the public to make this change? Does it seem like IU and other schools might be doing this in response to any kind of pressure?
You know, that's a good question. You really have to look to those individual communities. I think each state is so different. But I do know for students particularly, they are seeing a lot of change in the scope of admissions practices, I think. So it could be coming from that. I think it's also coming from a higher level of even university administrators getting together and discussing best practices. One thing that was mentioned at the Board of Trustees meeting by IU Bloomington Provost Lauren Rebell is that this is coming as IU looks to join an American Talent Initiative, kind of a consortium of university administrators across the country to broaden this array, like I mentioned before, of students applying into large universities. So I think we're seeing this discussion maybe even at several levels, maybe at the higher kind of academic officer level and down at the student level and looking at what, you know, students in high school who are getting ready to enter this admissions process.
And have you heard any pushback against this change, either inside or outside of IU, arguments that the test scores are valuable enough to keep using in this sort of primary way?
You know, what I've seen more so is discussion of, where should this be used? Where should this be applied to? There are some students who test well who want to provide that score. And that's kind of the point of a test optional is if you test well and you want to show that this is something that, you know, I'm particularly strong at, maybe you're a student who's looking to go into grad school down the road. You know, those are, you know, scores that could show an indicator that you would be ready for an environment where you're preparing for an LSAT, for example, or an MCAT. So there are a certain, you know, selection of students who still want to provide that. The university is allowing that opportunity. The other aspect of this is not all universities are the same when they go test optional. You know, some schools like Ball State, if you're applying for inter-school scholarships, they apply test optional to that as well. But, you know, there's some folks who say, you know, don't get your hopes up. Skip over your SAT just yet. There are some programs still, even within test optional universities, that require that score. So, some universities, if you're looking to apply direct admit into a program, want to see that score. So really the important aspect of this, I think, is research into what's best for you as a student, what program you're looking to enter.
We're talking to education reporter Carly Lanich from the Times of Northwest Indiana about IU considering going test optional with admissions tests like the ACT and SAT. Of the people you've talked to, Carly, who say ACT and SAT scores are not the most reflective measurement for whether students will succeed in college, what do they say is the most reflective measure?
Sure. So this is something that we see discussed quite a bit in admissions, and I don't think has really changed much over the years, including the SAT and ACT scores being factored in. But when you look at the college admissions process, a lot of counselors will tell you they're looking for a well-rounded student. So beyond just your SAT and ACT scores, they're looking for, an indicator of who you will be as a student in the classroom. That might be determined by a GPA, for example, the level of maybe dual credit or advanced placement courses you've taken. And they're also looking for who you might be as, a reliable, community-engaged fellow student. So they're also looking for things outside of the classroom that you're doing to further your education and further your community involvement. So it goes back to that. Maybe we're not going to look at this test score, this element of an application. That's something we'll allow you to decide if you'd like to provide us. But they are still going to look for those indicators that have kind of long been discussed in the admissions process, looking at again, it could be GPA, it could be your report card, it could be the level and intensity of courses you've taken to challenge yourself as a student, or always the college admissions essays, which are discussed and prepared for long in advance by students. Those are all other indicators that are pretty universally accepted at colleges across the country.
Did you get the sense from people at IU that they'll put more emphasis on other elements of a student's application if and when they remove these test scores?
That's a good question. I think it's yet to be seen exactly what it'll look like at IU, and there is some flexibility campus to campus. We'll have to kind of watch and follow what happens next at the campus level. How this is implemented at IU Bloomington may look very different than how it's implemented at IU Northwest or IU East or IU Fort Wayne. Those universities kind of cater to different student populations, so they may draft their own policies to fit. So that's something I think that remains to be seen at this point. Now, in other universities I've kind of looked into, it seems to be a sense of we want to consider a well-rounded application, that they're encouraging students to put their best foot forward, and that not necessarily there'll be more attention paid to a certain aspect, but as more attention paid to how students choose to portray themselves as a well-rounded individual.
The way GPAs are calculated is inconsistent to some degree from school to school, right? It seems like a lot of high schools handle it differently. Is that being talked about as another issue for admissions?
You know, that's really interesting, and something I haven't spent as much time looking into as I'd like, but I can tell you from my personal experience, I went to a high school that had a weighted GPA. I got into college and had students who said, oh, well, no one at my school earned more than a 4.0. Everyone kind of sets it a little differently. There's the 4.0 scale, a 5.0, some even go to 6. And then you compare that to, students applying from out of state, could be a completely different ballgame, right? So it is something I think that is taken similarly to the SAT and ACT in the sense that it's one aspect of your application. If you're, applying to school, I think it's important to know what the scale is on which your GPA is being based. So, you might say, I have a 3.6 on a scale of 4. but then also be able to supplement that with other aspects of your application. As far as how that GPA is considered, you know, I think that's another conversation that is going to continue to evolve over the years.
If these changes happen at a university, does it sound like they would apply to every program within the school in the same way?
Sure. So that's an excellent question. That's where I really encourage students to do their research. It depends university by university. And then under that umbrella, it really depends kind of college by college or school by school. Some programs still want to see that score. So you really need to make sure you're looking kind of to determine what your interest, where your interests align and what the best fit is for you as far as that application goes. I know when the University of Evansville, for example, first made their announcement moving to this policy a couple years back, they still are requiring direct entry students. So students who already know, for example, they might be looking to enter a health program, nursing, physical therapy, for example. Those are direct entry programs may still be looking for that SAT or ACT score, but that's not going to apply evenly across the board. So it's important for students to do their research and look individually. The other thing that's been really key in this and the universities that I have looked at, especially here in Indiana, is just reaching out to the college admissions offices at the university of your interest. There are folks there who are whose job it is to guide you through the process and help you determine what the best option is for you as a student.
Student testing is often at the center of a lot of conversations around education. And I'm curious where discussions about the ACT and SAT are right now. Can you explain where these tests come from and who runs them?
Sure. So the two big ones for college admissions, as we all know, are the ACT and the SAT. The ACT is overseen by a company, I think it's literally just called the ACT company, and then the SAT is by the College Board. Both provide a number of standardized testing services across the country at other levels, but they're best known for their college admissions tests. You know, this is all an interesting conversation coming now. The SAT is, you know, kind of been a long-time test that folks have relied on. The ACT is now making some changes in their process as far as how they're going to be testing students, the environment in which they're being tested, and how students can use those scores. There's been a lot of self-reflection within the industry to see what we can do to help students put their best foot forward. So, for example, the ACT announced this fall that they're going to move toward an online testing format. This is something that probably will be seen in select centers as early as next September and could continue to kind of be implemented on a rolling basis throughout the country, you know, as this program develops steam. The ACT historically hasn't allowed super scoring, and that's something they're looking to move forward to. So the practice of allowing a student to pull the best indicator in each subject if they've taken the test multiple times. So it's really coming at a time in testing in the industry, I think, where we're seeing a little bit of evolution here.
Got about 30 seconds left. So do we know how early this could start happening at IU campuses that they become test optional?
Sure. So it really is a campus-to-campus decision. But what we're hearing from some of our local campuses here in Indiana, if it moves along through the process, is that students applying to enter in the fall of 2021 could be among the first students to exercise this option.
Carly Lanich, education reporter at the Times of Northwest Indiana. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for the Friday Pitch-In, where we'll catch up on the latest headlines coming out of Indiana's 2020 legislative session. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. We're back tomorrow at this time. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.